because I think one of the most toxic legacies of Trump is that he has eroded our faith, or at least among many Americans, faith in the electoral process itself. And that needs to be restored.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Found another really good guest for right before the 2020 election. Lawrence Douglas is professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is very timely, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020. Lawrence was a good person to talk to about the election and what might go wrong with it, as well as matters ranging from free speech and academic freedom to reforms of the Electoral College. He's well worth your listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Lawrence, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
My name is Lawrence Douglas. I am the James J. Grossfeld Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. And I have recently published a book called Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020.
It strikes me that someone who would like to think about these matters and spend their life teaching and writing about it probably couldn't have found a much better place than Amherst. Sounds like a great place, is it?
Yes, it is a great place. I mean, like many of these colleges, there's a kind of strange squeeze that's going on if you're what I consider kind of a progressive liberal. On the one hand, I think progressive liberals are pretty appalled by national politics and the politics of Trump. And I have to unfortunately say, though, there is also this kind of, you know, contingent of pretty woke people who teach at these liberal arts colleges for whom progressive liberals are just one step short of fascists.
Do you find yourself in their crosshairs from time to time?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that. Yes, you do. And I think it's a very regrettable feature of our contemporary, you know, political moment in this nation, a very difficult moment.
What kinds of things place you there?
For example, if one is a kind of a robust defender of academic freedom and, you know, freedom of speech and inquiry, it's very, very regrettable that people think of free speech now as a weapon of the Milo Yiannopouloses of the world. And they, you know, have this feeling that it's been weaponized by people of the right, and that any aggressive defense of academic freedom and inquiry is aligning yourself with these forces of right-wing intolerance, which I think is, yeah, very regrettable.
I felt it, this notion that there's also intolerance coming from the left. Usually, I think, in service of fairly noble ideals, but also restrictive and unhappy.
I think that's certainly the case. I mean, in terms of the ideals that are being defended, they certainly are ones that I, you know, strongly sympathize with. And yet sometimes the mode of expression and the ways it's going about doing things are really pretty disturbingly intolerant.
So what do you do to cope with that? How do you handle that kind of situation?
You know, try to kind of engage in, you know, reasoned debate and argument as much as possible and try not to let intramural controversies in the college descend into the quality of a presidential debate.
Yeah. I have spent a couple of years, 3 years and a half maybe, interviewing progressive leaders across the spectrum, I would say, from well on the left to much more in the middle. I felt a little piece of that coming from some of the people who are more strident than others or more convinced of their rightness. And I think it's challenging in different venues.
Absolutely. I think moral stridency is a dangerous thing, whatever direction it's coming from.
I know you went to Brown, and you're, 6 years ahead of me in educational timeline. What was it like for you as an undergraduate then? How would you compare it?
Well, I had a pretty terrific time at Brown. Brown has an open curriculum, actually much in the same way that Amherst does today. Students were kind of able to sort of like steer their intellectual course of study. The other thing I would say at Brown is, at least at that moment, it was attracting a pretty interesting group of students, really quite creative thinkers, people who are trying to, think a little bit outside the box. And so I kind of really enjoyed that environment.
What did you study there?
So I actually, since I took advantage of the nice Brown open curriculum, I actually created my own independent concentration. It was basically a political theory independent concentration.
Yeah, good basis for your career, I would imagine. You went then to Columbia. What was the course of study there?
Well, so I actually started a PhD program at Columbia in political theory and grew weary of it very, very quickly, I have to say. Much as I kind of thought that the background in political theory was a very helpful grounding for thinking about issues in the world, I quickly discovered that I was not interested really in spending my career in the rarefied airs of theory. So I basically bailed on the PhD program after I'd gotten the master's.
And went to Yale Law.
Yes, exactly, the law school, which again was a very kind of open curriculum as well. So it was a very, I would say, surprisingly benign and enlightened place to study law, and had some really, terrific professors there.
What do you think was the key thing you took from your years in law school out into the rest of your career?
It's funny that you ask that, because, some of my classmates in law school felt that the experience of studying law very dramatically changed their way of thinking. I didn't feel that way very much. I mean, I kind of thought that really the background in political theory had given me sort of a pretty nice framing device to think about issues involving justice, morality, legality. So, in certain ways, the experience that I had in law school that was kind of best was the opportunity to work very closely with some, kind of wonderful professors like Owen Fiss and Burke Marshall, and to also edit a student journal that was dedicated to interdisciplinary legal scholarship.
What was your path from there to Amherst?
It was a pretty direct path, actually, for some idiosyncratic personal reasons. But basically, by the time I was done with law school, I was pretty sure that I wanted to go into legal academics. And I kind of assumed that I would teach at a law school. And it was just kind of serendipitous that Amherst was starting a experimental program called Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought. And it caught my eye, and the job description seemed to be disturbingly similar to the way I was describing myself going out onto the job market. And happily enough, I was able to land that position at Amherst.
Tell me about that program.
So it's a freestanding department. We have our own faculty, we have our own majors, and it really is something unique in the United States. I'm not really sure there's any other department exactly like our department. And I think the kind of the motivating impulse was the idea that the study of law really shouldn't be just placed in professional schools, that law plays such a central role in our politics, in our society, in our culture, that a department that really kind of subjects law to liberal arts inquiry instead of, you know, making it the study of professionals is something that's badly needed. And I think we took the model from from religious studies. So I think up until about the end of World War II, if you want to study religion, you really had to do it in a kind of, you know, theological seminary in a rabbinical school. And then you see the rise of these liberal arts religious studies majors. And that was kind of our model for the creation of this department.
Sounds really interesting. What have you mostly taught?
So because it's a liberal arts school, you know, I have to basically teach a range of courses. And some of them have been more directly in the area of my research and writing, and others have not. Right now, the kind of the standard courses I teach an introductory seminar on the rule of law, which is kind of like a general introduction to kind of notions of jurisprudence. I teach a course on constitutionalism and the Supreme Court in the United States. And then I also teach kind of more specific courses on things like judging genocide, a course about legal responses to the Holocaust.
And a couple books in that area. I know you have seven or so books, some fiction, some nonfiction. Tell me about the ones that come before the one we're going to talk about more.
I have published a couple of novels, and I have to say my great passion, you know, some professors actually like writing, some don't like writing. I like writing a lot, and it's pretty central to what I do. I mean, I consider myself, you know, a teacher and a writer, and I've always been pretty passionate about literature. So I have published a couple novels, which are basically, I think, you know, psychological realism, I would describe them as. They've been involved questions of Jewish identity. And then the other academic works that I've done have really focused on trials involving, criminal trials involving perpetrators and collaborators in the Holocaust. So I've written about the Nuremberg trial, about the Eichmann trial. I published a book about these kind of this long legal odyssey of this guy named John Demjanjuk, who was a SS collaborator and who was tried in a number of different countries over a pretty long period of time.
What is it about writing that you like it so much?
I've always been a passionate reader. I started, you know, keeping a list of everything I've read starting in sixth grade. I've always admired writers, and it's just something that I've always kind of enjoyed doing it. And one thing that I've noticed is I am a notoriously slow reader. I read very, very slowly, but I write pretty quickly. And, you know, I certainly have friends who are professional writers who describe the writing process as a torture, that even if they like having written something, they don't enjoy the process of writing it. But that's never been my experience. I've always had a very happy experience actually writing itself. I find it very, not always does it go well, but I generally enjoy doing it.
I'm kind of envious of that. It's more of a struggle for me. Why these trials of Nazis? What's making you spend your time on that?
I think right after I graduated Brown, I had a fellowship to study in Germany. The time that I spent in Germany, ended up spending about 2 years there. And I became really interested in the way Germans were dealing with that past, with the National Socialist past. Some of the dealings I thought were pretty impressive, and some of them I thought were pretty appalling. And I remember having all these discussions with people at the time where people would say, well, look, you know, we had the Holocaust, the United States had the war in Vietnam, you know, thinking that, well, look, I'm not a big defender of the war in Vietnam, but excuse me, I don't think we'd necessarily want to draw an equivalence to those atrocities. And then when I started studying law, that kind of interest in the way nations come to terms with a past history of state-sponsored criminality was something that just always fascinated me.
I'm Jewish, and when I've talked to people about Trump, I've noticed that some of the Jewish people I've talked to seem to have, I don't know, access to a different feeling about him that I think is linked to knowledge about what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s. Do you think that that lens, which you have more than most people, affects how you think about him?
I think to a degree. I mean, something that I've always, you know, tried to warn my students, I try to warn them of the dangers of what I call reductio ad nazium, meaning that, you know, anytime something goes wrong, well, it means that we're, you know, on the path towards, you know, collapsing into the Third Reich. So I certainly like resisting that impulse. You know, at the same time, you know, I do think we need to be aware about the vulnerabilities of political systems. Now, I certainly think the United States has a far, far more robust democratic tradition and culture than did Weimar Germany have in the 20s. And we also have much more powerful institutions than did Weimar Germany have. At the same time, though, we've seen some pretty disturbing things in the last 3.5 years about how easily what we thought were these, you know, pretty powerful bulwarks can be deformed.
One of the things that becomes very clear when you read your book is that there's a lot of looseness to this system, to the way it was set up a long time ago with the Electoral College and the way it goes to Congress in a disputed election that is not really well aligned with the notion of sort of who gets the most votes wins now. And, you know, we've seen that with the Electoral College going wrong twice in the last 16 years, but it feels like, I think you call them catastrophes. There's a bunch of paths to real trouble right now. I know you've kind of gone through this with people, but talk about the scenarios in your book, just so that people can understand why we might end up with Congress deciding who the next president is, or the courts, or a mixture of things.
Right. Well, maybe I'll just say 2 points at the outset. One is, I think you're absolutely right to point out that, you know, one of the things that I try to point out in the book is that, you know, when you talk about the peaceful transfer of power, that it really isn't something that our system secures. It's something that the system presupposes. It kind of just assumes it's going to happen. So it really is not at all well designed to deal with a president like a Trump, who seems, you know, more than willing to just kind of smash through these norms and to engage in a constitutional brinkmanship. And then, you know, the other thing I think is worth bearing in mind is also, as you suggested, that a lot of the worries that we have about the upcoming election, I think, are badly exacerbated by this archaic system by which we go about electing presidents, the Electoral College. I don't think we would have nearly as grave worries about what we're about to see if we had, for example, a national public vote. It is almost certain that Trump will lose a national public vote very decisively, probably more decisively than his 3 million vote loss to Hillary Clinton in 2016. But if you have a president who's going to engage in, you know, who plays this politics of chaos and electoral rejection, it's much easier to reject a defeat that turns on, let's say, a 10,000 vote margin in a swing state of, say, Pennsylvania, than it is to reject 3 million votes nationwide. That's a hard thing to do. It's easy to create a chaos narrative out of a very narrow defeat in, let's say, one or a couple of swing states.
I mean, what's interesting to me is how much he's betraying a plan to do that, or it sort of seems that way. Like the whole campaign against mail-in ballots and some of the other lawyering up and planning seems like I'm getting ready to contest a close election. What tea leaves do you read?
I think you're exactly right. There are no tea leaves to read. I mean, one thing about Trump that we have to say is it's all pretty out in the open. You know, why did you fire Comey as FBI director? Well, I was trying to stop the probe into Russia. I mean, it's all pretty out in the open. And he has, in a sense, revealed his strategy pretty transparently. And the strategy seems to be that he's aware that if he has any chance whatsoever of winning this election, he has to have a lead on November 3rd itself, and that he is prepared to take whatever lead he has on November 3rd and to kind of leverage that into a claim that he has won the election. And then when that lead erodes through the count of these mail-in ballots, he will simply say, all my predictions are coming true. The mail-in ballots have been contaminated by fraud by these radical Democrats, and we can't trust the result from the mail-in ballots. We need to go with the November 3rd results. It's all pretty clearly laid out for us.
What's most astonishing to me is that he would think to try to slow down the Postal Service in service of that.
Yeah, even though I have to say it's not an idiotic thing to do. It has its own kind of tactical brilliance behind it. Because one of the ways that he could try to, again, kind of leverage a lead into a claim of victory is if he is able to create a tremendous amount of chaos and confusion around the count of mail-in ballots. And one reason for disqualifying mail-in ballots is if they have not been submitted in a timely fashion. And so if he is able to use the USPS as a tool for slowing the delivery of mail-in ballots, that basically becomes a tool for disqualifying those ballots, potentially. And that both is helpful to him simply in the sense of voter suppression, but it's also helpful to him in the sense of just creating chaos around the count. Because then the count will be enveloped in litigation, and all of that is going to take days or weeks to sort out. And all that time, he will be out there, you know, tweeting reliably, I've been reelected. What's happening in these states is a disgrace. It's confirming everything I predicted. You'll have his megaphones in the right-wing media repeating what he's saying. And you can add to that mix a Russian disinformation campaign on social media, also suggesting that the count of mail-in ballots has been hopelessly corrupted.
It's enough to make you sweat.
Yes, it really is. It's a source of great concern. There's no doubt about that.
What I'm pretty sure that a lot of people don't know, although a lot of people do, is that contested elections can come down to, and have in history, come down to votes in the House of Representatives, and that they're not done by a majority in the House of Representatives. So you have almost an electoral college-like scheme to do it by state delegation. Can you kind of walk through the scenario?
And even before we get to the House, so again, this gets a little granular, but as you just suggested, so let's say in this particular election, Pennsylvania ends up turning as the key swing state. Whoever carries Pennsylvania will win the White House. And the mail-in ballot vote in Pennsylvania, the count of mail-in ballots, again, becomes a kind of enveloped in charges of human error, which no doubt will occur. I mean, we've just seen the way in which Trump recently was able to turn an instance in which 9 ballots were accidentally tossed out by a part-time employee who had been on the job for exactly 3 days, how Trump was able to turn that into some kind of evidence of this huge conspiracy to disenfranchise his voters, since 7 of those 9 ballots apparently had his name on them. If the count becomes, again, sort of litigated and confused, it's possible to imagine that the Republican-controlled legislature in Pennsylvania would recognize Trump as the winner. And it's likewise possible to imagine that the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania would recognize Biden as the winner. And in which case, when Congress on January 6, 2021, performs its constitutional function of counting the Electoral College votes, it's suddenly confronted with this kind of competing result from Pennsylvania. If Congress remains divided as it is now, then there's really kind of no way out of that stalemate. I don't see a way out of that stalemate. It doesn't seem clear how Congress could figure out who won Pennsylvania.
Wouldn't they just vote by delegation to pick one?
That's one step further down the line, actually.
Okay.
So this is something, the actual count of the Electoral College votes, that is something that a joint session of Congress does. And if you have a Senate that's Republican, they would recognize, presumably, Trump's electoral win in Pennsylvania. And if you have a Democratic House, the House members would presumably recognize Biden's electoral win in Pennsylvania. And if you have that, then again, that becomes a recipe for stalemate. Now, there's some, you know, kind of other ways in which things could go very strangely wrong. So let's say there's an actual Electoral College tie somehow, or for some reason, certain states' Electoral College votes are tossed out altogether. Then it is the case that if no one has received an Electoral College majority, by the terms of the Constitution, the House would be responsible for electing the president. And that is an incredibly anti-democratic scheme because, as you suggested, it's not that each House member gets a vote. Because if that were the case, it seems Biden would clearly win since there's a decisive Democratic majority in the House. But it's actually the case that each House delegation gets a single vote. So California, with its 40 million inhabitants, has the same power in the House to elect the president as would Wyoming with its 550,000 inhabitants. And it's also possible to imagine that in the wake of the 2020 election, that the House delegations themselves will be split evenly 25 to 25, in which case, again, we have a total stalemate. It's possible to imagine that the Supreme Court could be asked to intervene in a case that involves the counting of mail-in ballots. Again, let's just stick with Pennsylvania, that there could be some issue involving whether these, let's say these, tens of thousands of ballots that would change the outcome in Pennsylvania have been disqualified because they arrived too late. And then the argument is, well, they arrived too late because of the USPS late delivery. Question like that, you know, whether those should be disqualified or qualified, that could go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But if, for example, the crisis ends up in the hands of Congress, as we were just describing, at that point, I think a lot of constitutional experts would say the Supreme Court has no role to play whatsoever. It's really now up to Congress to figure things out. And they don't necessarily have the ability to do so.
What's the role of the calendar in this? Because what I remember from 2000 was the court sort of said, we ran out of time, we can't do recounts.
That's right.
Which seemed like a pretty bogus way to make a decision, but it's what happened.
Yeah, that's right. Because there are some dates that I think most Americans have absolutely no knowledge of whatsoever. And so we know that on November 3rd, we go to, at least some of us would be voting in person. And we know that as of January 20th, that's when Inauguration Day is. And that's also when, unless he's been reelected, Trump's term of office officially ends at noon. So between November 3rd and January 20th, there are a couple of other dates we need to pay attention to. And one of them is December 8th. And December 8th is basically the day that in this election season, federal law establishes for basically telling the states, you need to have figured out who won your state by December 8th. So between November 3rd and December 8th, the states have about 5 weeks to kind of finish their whole count of votes and to make sure that count has been, you know, properly conducted. Because just a few days later, on December 14th, the electors in the various states go to their state capitals and actually cast their votes. And in order for the electors to go to the state capitol, they have to know whether, for example, if you're going to Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, if it's Biden's electors who are going to Harrisburg, or Trump's electors who are going to Harrisburg. So the state needs to figure out a few days before that who has won the state. And that is the situation that if the count starts to bump up against those dates, that's when you could have the situation in which the legislature says, hell, we're running out of time. We think from all our indications, Trump has won. And the governor says, no, 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 Biden has won. Those are really important days in this season that I think very, very few people are paying attention to.
I'm not sure I understand that legislature versus legislature and governor or governor situation. Like on most legislation, it's got to pass the legislature and then, you know, be signed by a governor. Is this a normal thing that the legislature can have a position on its own?
It's again a kind of a somewhat confusing thing because according to the Constitution, the legislature can choose electors in whatever way they want. It is a prerogative of the legislature. It can and certainly create litigation because a lot of the stuff is, you know, we hope that we have, oh, what's the clear answer to this? And one of the things you expect from, at least from law, is you expect that, yeah, I can drive 65 miles an hour because that's what the law says. Anything above it, that's the law says I can't drive at that speed without running the risk of getting a ticket. So there, it gives us pretty clear, bright lines. With a lot of the stuff, we just don't have these bright lines. The legal materials are not necessarily particularly clear, or they simply haven't envisioned certain scenarios. And in our history, they haven't been litigated and resolved. So a lot of the stuff, if you start really pushing against the institutional fabric, you could find that there are all these kind of gaps and holes. That's one of the things that makes the whole situation so troublesome.
How close do you think it has to be for a fight like this to take place? Speculate a little bit about like what he can get away with.
Sure. It's a little bit difficult to give, you know, precise numbers, but if we just think back to 2016, so 2016 was basically Trump won the White House by carrying Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan by a total of 78,000 votes. That's more than the 537 votes that gave George W. Bush the White House when he carried Florida by that margin, when the Supreme Court stepped in to stop the recount in Florida. We have to bear in mind that 78,000 is also a minuscule number. And if the election turns on those kinds of numbers again, but those numbers are now breaking in Biden's favor, yeah, you could see, I think, lots of chaos. What's behind also your question is, you know, how big a defeat would he have to experience in order to spare us this type of chaos? Obviously, that defeat would have to be not just in the popular vote, it would have to be in the Electoral College, and it would have to be in swing states as well. Even in those circumstances, I think Trump would continue to grouse and continue to insist that the election had been stolen from him, but I think he would have no other opportunity. He would basically have to submit to defeat, even if he continued to claim that it was all the result of fraud.
It doesn't take much of a feat of imagination to think about the chaos that could take place if he's claiming the election's been stolen, if he was ahead on election day and someone called it a red mirage, and to have people on the streets marching around with guns and potentially firing them.
Yep. That is a nightmare scenario, isn't it? And yes, I mean, this is something I think we all need to be really, really concerned about because we've seen the way in which, you know, Trump engages in these dog whistle politics. We saw that on the debate stage when he refused to repudiate white supremacists and, in fact, came out with this remarkable statement of, you know, Proud Boys stand down and stand by. That's a very, very disturbing thing to be issuing from the White House. And it's, you know, the prospect of some, you know, civil unrest and real violence on the streets, I think we have to sadly acknowledge is very real.
What do you think ought to be done by people who are concerned about this and want to make sure that we have a peaceful transition, especially to Biden? What do you know that's being done and what ought to be done that isn't?
I think handing him a really decisive defeat would be crucial. And I think one of the ways to do that, and, you know, I suppose it's important for that decisive defeat to be clear relatively early on. That is, even if we still have this red mirage, so to speak, on November 3rd, that mirage disappears and we can start seeing the real political reality pretty quickly thereafter. So I think if people are voting by mail-in ballot, they should do it very early so it doesn't get caught up in the delays of the USPS. There are many states that permit, for example, if you are voting in person, to vote in days before election day. And in doing so, you can hopefully minimize the health risks associated with in-person voting on election day when the lines might be substantially longer. I think it's also really important for citizens groups to organize poll monitoring groups to make sure that there's no intimidation of voters that is going on from, let's say, Trump supporters. And this is certainly something that Biden is all over, is he needs to have these very, very experienced legal teams ready at the instant to start fighting whatever kind of legal challenges Trump raises. I mean, the experience in 2000 pretty clearly indicated that the Democrats were always steps behind the Republicans in their legal maneuvers. And the Democrats this time, I think it's safe to say, have been pretty aggressive in plotting out not simply how they would respond, but how they would act.
I mean, you've been watching the changes in the courts that Trump has been able to affect, McConnell has been able to affect. Do you have a faith that they will ultimately do the right thing in a tight situation, or how much concern do you have?
It certainly depends a little bit about what court we're talking about. I mean, it does seem like that, at least in terms of some of his lower court appointments, you have some, you know, real loyalists now in the federal judiciary. If we're talking about the Supreme Court, the assumed confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, you know, adds a kind of interesting wild card to the mix. You know, I think it's fair to say that even though John Roberts is a deeply conservative jurist, that he's also a real institutionalist. Again, this is just speculation, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that, you know, John Roberts thinks that Trump is unfit for being president. It might also be the case that other of his appointees to the Supreme Court, like Neil Gorsuch or Brett Kavanaugh, it's not impossible to imagine that they agree with that. It's very, very hard to predict since we just haven't really seen enough of how this court deals with issues of executive power.
Let's say Biden wins thoroughly and takes office without this kind of drama. What would you advise in terms of reform so that should we have another Trump, whether it's an offspring or just another person willing to play these sort of games, so that they're not able to take advantage of these sort of moves in the future?
Well, I think it would be wonderful if we could move to some kind of national public vote system. It's a very difficult, tricky thing to do. The Electoral College is in the Constitution, but there are, you know, promising proposals out there that are presently being actively pursued to try to move us to a national popular vote. And I think that would be very, very helpful. I think there can also be all sorts of ways in which we can try to at least somewhat nationalize our election system. We don't have a national election system. We don't even really have a state election system. We basically have, you know, 8,000 plus, you know, precincts and localities that conduct what ultimately adds up to a presidential election. And that can create an incredible vulnerability in the system because depending on you know, what state emerges as the swing state. If you simply target the weakest link in the system, you can create chaos in the entire system. So a kind of a real dedication on Congress's part to infusing money and know-how to making sure that these elections are conducted in a responsible fashion that reassures the public. Because I think one of the most toxic legacies of Trump is that he has eroded our faith, or at least among many Americans, faith in the electoral process itself. And that needs to be restored.
What else from the book that you haven't had a chance to talk about would you like to highlight?
I think you've asked terrific questions. You know, maybe I don't know if this is the kind of thing that I can mention during a podcast, but if anyone is interested in purchasing the book, I just want to let you know that everything that I earn from sales, I'll be donating to a charity. So I'm not in this for personal self-enrichment. I really think of the book, in my hopes, of course, as a way of helping to prepare our democracy for danger and how to respond to it. So maybe that's the last thing I would mention.
Well, I can just say it's a very tight and clear and interesting and kind of scary account of some scenarios and what might happen. I'm also curious about this lens that you have of studying trials of Nazis. I wonder what that makes you think about how we can clean up after Trump. No one is saying that this is any comparison, but he hasn't invaded other countries, killed millions of people, nothing like that. But he has definitely corrupted the dialogue. He's lied all the time. He's fired people he shouldn't fire in ways he shouldn't. There's just a long list of messes and self-enrichment going on that we got to kind of clean up after. What do you think we've learned from ways other countries have done that we might want to do here?
Well, I think the point you make is really important, because he has certainly attacked and eroded the rule of law. And one of the areas in which he's done that is in the way he's kind of grossly politicized some of the work of the Department of Justice, and the way in which Bill Barr has emerged as really his most aggressive and resourceful sword and shield. The rule of law does not stand for the proposition that you turn your opponents into criminals and that you turn your friends who are criminals into innocent creatures. I mean, that is a corruption of the rule of law. And so one thing I think would be critical for Biden is to restore our confidence in the department, in the neutral administration of justice. With regards to Trump himself, I think we need to, of course, likewise, make sure that even if we have passionate rejection of him as a president, that we don't then simply equate that with criminal activity. On the other hand, a dedication to the rule of law means that if he has conducted criminal acts, then he needs to face his day in court. And no one is above the law. And again, those criminal acts might have nothing to do with the things that he did during the presidency. They might not. But we do know that, for example, Cyrus Vance Jr. in New York has been looking into the Trump Corporation. And if there are indictable offenses with regards to, let's say, money laundering, tax fraud, those kinds of things, then I think our dedication to the rule of law means that we need to be prepared to see our former president seeing his day in court.
Well, you know, one of the political realities of that, though, is that he's going to be around doing mischief, most likely, as are his offspring. And, you know, I wonder what some people might view as persecuting him, even if it is following the rule of law, might help give them a route back into power.
Yep. No, that's absolute danger. And it's a danger that you see in these kind of also these, you know, these post-authoritarian nations, you know, where it's unmistakably the case where their former leaders have committed all sorts of human rights abuses. And the question is whether this system is stable enough to bring these former leaders to a trial. There's no doubt that, you know, bringing a criminal trial against a former president is a high stakes proceeding. But the idea that we shy away from it simply because we fear the political repercussions of people who then try to make him into a martyr really suggests that the rule of law is weaker in this country than I think we'd like to believe.
How much at the end of the day do you worry about this president and whether he will go?
I worry a decent amount. Again, my big hope is that, and it seems increasingly likely, or not increasingly likely, but maybe just increasingly possible, that Biden really will have the kind of decisive victory that could spare us all this grief. That's my hope. So the hope is really about the decisiveness of Biden's victory. I have very little faith in Trump himself in ever, you know, taking the high road or doing the right thing.
I'm curious about your thoughts about the role of a professor in this day and age, about if you have such clarity about the risk of this president, to what degree should a professor be sort of campaigning or teaching their students or out there advocating, and to what degree is that not compatible with that role?
It's a really, really important and difficult question. Because in general, you know, since I mentioned this a little bit at the outside, I'm kind of one of these nice, you know, progressive liberals who really believes in respecting different points of view, of playing devil's advocate, of trying to never think about my job as a professor as being one of indoctrination, but it's one of trying to challenge, stimulate, prod. But, you know, it's tricky in this case, because if I really do believe, as I do, that Trump, you know, represents something, you know, of a potentially existential threat to American democracy, I do think it's important for me to at least present that case to students, and not to do it in a doctrinaire fashion, but to do it in a way that invites dialogue. If students disagree, which I always encourage students to express their disagreement, to see if we can listen to the opposing point of view and see which side has the superior argument. So I think the responsibility is one of reasoned persuasion, you know, and marshaling arguments rather than one of, you know, trying to foist a particular point of view.
I mean, I've noticed that some subjects are super hard to discuss right now without people starting to yell. You know, questions of race and privilege and economics, where people are very passionate, particularly on the left. How do you advise young people to put themselves, like we kind of led the discussion with that, but how do you advise people to find a way to discuss things like that that are so charged?
It's a tricky thing. It really is a tricky thing, because if you say to people, like, you know, it's so important for us to maintain civil discourse and, you know, reasoned argument, and, you know, then people can come back and say, yeah, you can say that because you're a privileged white tenured professor in an elite institution. If you were facing the kind of, you know, institutional systemic racism that we're facing, you wouldn't be singing that same song. It's a really, really tricky one. But I do think that we have enough examples from history that even people who are, you know, really suffering ultimately can prevail through what I hope is the, you know, dedication to these liberal values.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic for our country?
So I wrote a novel called The Catastrophist. I've teaching a course on the meaning of catastrophe. I write books about, you know, the Holocaust and these. I hate to say it, I'm not a hugely optimistic guy. Now, so I don't necessarily want to say that, you know, so that's any kind of intellectual position as much as it is a dispositional. You know, I look out there, it's not a whole lot that makes me feel hugely optimistic, but man, I would love to be shown wrong.
Is there a question that I failed to ask that you'd like to answer?
No. You've been really terrific. It's been a really interesting, wide-ranging conversation. I'm very grateful for it. So it's really very good.
I'm very appreciative of your time. And thank you. It's been an honor. Anything else you want to say?
No, but it was a really terrific conversation. Thanks so much for having it.
That was Professor Lawrence Douglas of Amherst College. His latest book is Will He Go? This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.